Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. It's Arab American Heritage Month, part three on this show. Up first, last week, as some of you heard, we invited listeners of Arab descent to call in and share your immigration stories. Here in year four, after President Biden declared April Arab American Heritage Month in the United States in 2021. And we had so many great stories we didn't have time to hear, so we're coming back to it again today for a part two. So listeners, call in with your Arab American family's immigration story to America, 212-433-WNYC. And of course, this could be yourself, but it could be your parents' story, it could be your grandparents' story, or earlier ancestors from anywhere in the Arab world. Tell us your family immigration story to America at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Our phones are open for you. And we're going to add one more part to our question to you for today, which is, are the events in the Middle East particularly difficult for you right now in the context of being Arab American? We try to hear all voices here. We listened with our guest Noah Feldman this week to how difficult a time it is for many American Jews on this Passover week. Now, Arab Americans in this Arab American Heritage Month segment, maybe you have Palestinian roots. Has the war brought you closer to those roots in some way? Or people from any other Arab background? How about people of Middle Eastern descent who are Christian? Because Arabs are not all Muslims. There are also some Arab Jews, even though we don't usually think about Jews in that category. But yes, Yemeni Jews, Syrian Jews, or at least of descent from those countries. So maybe your child, you are a child of an interfaith marriage. What sorts of thoughts are you having right now if at least part of your family is Arab American? Are you coming to new thoughts about identity as time goes on in this country? 212-433-WNYC. Our phones are open at 212-433-9692, particularly for your Arab American family's immigration story. And you can talk about your feelings as an Arab American in the context of the Gaza war. And joining us for this round two of your calls and to take us through some of the history of immigration, once again, is Maya Berry, Executive Director of the Arab American Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan national civil rights advocacy organization. Maya, thanks so much for joining us for this again.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you so much for the way that you've been covering this month. It's incredibly meaningful.
Thank you. And the last time you were on, we had a caller share how her family landed in the United States and then moved around a bunch. Did most Arab immigrants land in New York City during those early waves of immigration that we focused on in part one, the 1800s to the early 1900s? If they ended up in other cities or states, where did they go? How much kind of movement? Like, how did they wind up in Michigan? Everybody's talking about the Arab population in Michigan these days. There's no port in Michigan, as far as I know.
No,
except
no
on
port.
A lake.
Yeah, wonderful lakes, many wonderful lakes. Yes, you're talking indeed to a Michigander, so that'll come through.
Wow.
Yes, I mean, like the many immigrants that have come to the United States during that period, a lot of them came through New York City. It's the reason that during our last conversation, we talked about what we called the original colony in Little Syria, that lower Manhattan in New York City. But you know, given how, frankly, scrappy immigrants have to be, right? They arrive and they have to find a way to make a living. So you will find that many will follow, for economic reasons, different areas where they can settle. And the earlier Arab immigrants, we had a lot who were peddlers. So it's a small, think about the person that would show up with a cart to provide a particular product. And they were in many of those sort of major urban industrial cities that we would think of. So we had New York, we had Boston, we had Pittsburgh. And certainly Detroit metropolitan area was part of it. My story is a little different. I'm actually an immigrant to this country. I'm a product of the third wave of immigrants. My family and I came here during the Lebanese Civil War, specifically came to the U.S., the idea being that we would be here for a short period of time and then go back after the war ended, where the Lebanese War lasted 15 years. So we didn't go back. And we settled in Dearborn, Michigan. I'm actually also from Dearborn, though we had no connection to the auto industry, but my aunts and uncles who were there previous to us were there. So it was a family immigration pattern and ended up settling there. The Dearborn story is a fascinating one. I'd love to spend more time on it because it's I'm very protective of a community I care deeply about, but I also think it's so deeply misunderstood. When I see Dearborn, Michigan trending on social media, my heart sinks a bit because I know it's never a story about this incredible place. But rather a lot of discrimination and often bigotry.
Well, give us an example of what's missing.
Well, the first is Dearborn, Michigan, Henry Ford's history there specifically was in the Guinness Book of World Records at one point for having the most languages spoken. The idea being immigrants were showing up for that famous $5 a week job, and it was a way to be able to earn a living. And our community came to Dearborn for those very reasons early on, like I said, like all other immigrants, and settled there during that initial wave, primarily at the time as Christian immigrants. The earlier immigrants were predominantly from the Mount Lebanon region of the Middle East, of the Arab world, and they were mainly Christians. But we began to see a change, and a lot of the Muslim immigrants began to arrive in the Detroit area after the 1970s, folks like myself. And you have an incredibly rich, diverse community that's there. When you talk about, how did they end up there during, for example, the Iraq War, where we began to see additional Iraqi refugees arrive here in the United States. They would arrive and we would, via programs, provide settlement dollars, and they would be sent to different parts of the country. And they would find their way to Dearborn because they knew there was a high concentration of Arab Americans there and people, wanted to be part of that area. And it's an incredibly interesting story where we now have our first Arab American elected mayor of that city in 2021. It's a city that has a challenging sort of history in terms of its racism, frankly. It's surrounded in part by Detroit, Michigan, and had a history of a very anti-Black mayor at the time during the 1968 riots, famous for having stood at the border with a weapon, suggesting that Black citizens ought not to come into the city. For years, Dearborn had something called Keep Dearborn Clean as a campaign for presumably litter, but it was definitely understood that it was rooted in a very real anti-Black racist history. So I always talk about this sort of interesting kind of dynamic where you had a history with a lot of just blatant anti-Black racism, but yet it was the immigrants who came across the Atlantic and settled there. And it's part of the American story. You cannot prevent progress.
There you go. So, like Maya, any other Lebanese Americans listening right now? It's not a population that gets a lot of press with other Middle Eastern countries. More in the news in recent years. She was mentioning Iraq. We know about the Syrian refugees. Guy who hired me here was Lebanese-American, old program director back in the day. So there are Lebanese-Americans in our midst. Anyone out there right now wants to tell your Lebanese family crossing story to the United States? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And let's tick through some more history, mostly chronologically. Arab American immigration through the decades has been fraught because of how the United States has tried to categorize people of Arab descent. I know that's going to change in the next segment. We did in the next census, we did a segment on that this month. Discriminatory laws such as the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act limited immigration and prevented Asians from becoming U.S. citizens. And at that time, Maya, there was a question, wasn't there, as to whether Arab immigrants were Asian, right?
Yeah, it's a fascinating history in terms of understanding this. And actually, it comes up directly to the segment that you covered previously with regards to the new Middle East and North African MENA category, because people, when we were advocating for decades to try to get a new category on the census, sometimes folks would say, you know, we've not encountered a community that doesn't want to be white anymore, quote unquote. And I would have to explain that this effort wasn't necessarily about not being categorized as racially white. It was about not being characterized as racially white exclusively. The thing to understand is that Arab Americans are a diverse community. They can be white, they can be black, they can identify in different ways. And when we talk about this period, the story I love to share is of a police officer named George Shishmi in Venice, California, who had arrested the son of a prominent attorney for disturbing the peace. And one of the defenses against that was posed against George at the time, this was in 1909, was that you can't arrest my son because you are not a citizen and you're not eligible for citizenship. And that court case, George went to
Wasn't
court.
he of Lebanese descent too? Do I have that history right?
He absolutely. So that the period then is it, Lebanon hadn't even been declared an independent state. We're still talking about Lebanon,
Right.
Mount Lebanon. So it's the greater Syria.
Yeah.
But he was indeed
Ottoman Empire. Yeah.
That's correct. He was indeed Lebanese, and he went to court, and because of the Asian Exclusionary Act, because of the fact that at the time, citizenship was directly tied to European ancestry. You could not become a citizen unless you were. He fought in court and used the line that George was also Christian, and he said, if Jesus were white, then I too am white. And that is a historic case that takes us back to this narrative about the identity of Arab Americans in this country. But the
Right.
reality was, it was a very pragmatic and practical approach that George and Arab Americans then were taking to be able to receive citizenship and become naturalized.
And I have that quote from federal court because you tipped us off to it. George Hashim said, "If I am a Mongolian, meaning Asian, if I am a Mongolian, then so is Jesus because we came from the same land." Wow. Ernie in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ernie.
Hi, Brian. Thanks. It's a pleasure to talk to you. My grandparents emigrated from what was then, as your guests were saying, Syria, and is now Lebanon, and somehow found themselves moving to Nebraska. And the interesting thing about their story is that they somehow my grandfather made a trade with some guy, and he acquired 60 acres of land to homestead in a little town south of Millboro, South Dakota, right on the Nebraska border. And they moved in 1910. They traveled in a wagon several hundred miles from O'Neill, Nebraska, to south of Millboro, which is literally and still is in the middle of nowhere, and homesteaded for 10 years. From 1910 to 1920, in South Dakota. Well, I thought it was a fascinating story.
I just love he
Go ahead,
I
Maya.
love
You
hearing
go.
no, I just love hearing that, because that really, I didn't mention it, but homesteading was absolutely part of our history in this country. With South Dakota, North Dakota, Oklahoma, there were community folks who did exactly as the caller's grandfather did.
Yeah, and what an example of what you were saying before about people moving around and, not just settling in New York or on the coasts. Another bit of history that we're actually going to do a deep dive on later in the year, the Johnson-Reed Act quota system. 100 years ago this year, starting in 1924, it drastically reduced the number of Arab immigrants to the United States for 4 decades. About 1,000 people from Arab countries, only 1,000, were allowed into the U.S. per year, according to the Arab American National Museum. And of course, that 1924 Very Restrictive Immigration Act was a backlash to Ellis Island generally and restricted immigration for all kinds of people until it loosened up in the 60s. We're going to do a 100-year lens on the Johnson-Reed Act later in the year. But can you talk a little bit about that period of time in the context of Arab American immigration in particular?
I think it's incredibly important that you're going to cover it, because it really was in some ways indicative of a change in our country that I think we are struggling with now. It was indeed the first time that we put in numerical limits on immigration. We began a national immigration quota system at the time. And like other immigrants who didn't come from Europe, Arab Americans were deeply impacted by it. You saw at the Arab American National Museum, number is absolutely correct. You saw a major restriction of the number of folks that had come in during that first wave that we talked about before the act. So the 1880 to 1924 period, you had roughly about almost 100,000 Arab immigrants come to the United States during that period, among the 20 million immigrants that had come during that period as well. And then you get this act and you have a complete restriction that gets put in place. So the only folks that were able to come in during that period were educated and elite folks from different countries. We were looking for doctors or engineers. So you saw some numbers from Iraq and Egypt and Palestine, again, the greater Syria area. But it really it changed the way that folks were coming into the U.S. and changed our country during that period.
A little more oral history now from Layla May in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Layla May.
Hello.
Hello.
My name's Layla May, as you know. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Layla.
Hello.
May. Yes. Can you hear me?
Well, I am, yes. I am from Lebanon, but I came here via Europe originally because I was studying there when the Lebanese War broke out, the Civil War. And after living several years in England and in France, I realized I could never become a French person or a British person in the same way you can become an American. And my boyfriend at the time had a American nationality. We came here on a fiancé visa. And I'm very glad I made the move. And New York is my choice because I started in Chicago, but I felt too much like an alien there.
Huh.
And New York is home to everyone.
Layla May, thank you very much. Beautiful piece of oral history. Let's go right on to somebody else. Maria in Fairfield County in Connecticut. You're on WNYC. Hi, Maria.
Thank you for taking my call. I came as an undergraduate, 17-year-old alone, not as an immigrant, and ended up falling in love with an American and stayed here. But what I want to say, and this was in 1966, what I want to say is that there are a lot of Syrians who come out of the medical school in Syria because it's much better to be a doctor here than there. Obviously highly educated. If you look in Cleveland, if you look in all over the place, and you have states and Memorial Sloan Kettering, a lot of Syrian doctors. It's a bit of a income issue. So you have obviously the refugees, but you also have a very large portion of well-educated people from Syria and Lebanon that come here for politically the life there is not very good.
And it's part of the pattern of immigration, certainly since the year that you cited that you came, when a lot changed. 1966, you said, Mario, right?
Yeah, I came as an undergraduate student, so I didn't come as a refugee or anything. I came on a student visa and ended up staying. But I know a lot of people that came in the 80s when things really turned bad in Syria. And they're doctors. I mean, all those guys I know are doctors if you look all over the country.
Thank you for
it's a very mixed picture.
Absolutely.
Of atheists and Christians.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. Thank you for that story and for raising that pattern, Maya. It's a common pattern from a number of countries. India comes to mind as one where you get the elite in the first wave who qualify in certain easier ways to qualify for immigration to the United States. And then under the 1965 immigration law, they can bring in their siblings. It got nicknamed, I'm sure you know this, the Brothers and Sisters Act. And the battle continues to this day with people trying to restrict that kind of what they call chain migration through the relatives. But the people who get the toehold for the families are often people who are admitted more easily because they have those professional skills, doctors, as Maria says, or others. And I wonder how true you'd say that pattern holds for waves of immigration from the Arab world since the law changed to liberalize immigration in the 60s.
Yeah, indeed, Brian, that's exactly right. You know, in our case, that first wave that came were actually not necessarily skilled, right? These are folks who came here initially. It's the second wave that you're talking about that we just mentioned, where you had to be highly skilled in order to get beyond the strict immigration laws that were put in place. And what's that, when you're, Maria talks about Syrian doctors leaving Syria, you really did see a significant brain drain in those countries of origin as a product of that. And then we get to this third wave, which is, as you said, after the INA passed and the many important developments after the INA's 1965 passage. But one of the most important things is what you just said, really, the family visa system was put in place. So it's the family reunification. It's again technically how we got to come here. Right? Both my mother and father had siblings that were here in the U.S., and it's part of the way that we were able to come. But the other point I want to mention about Maria is, you know, when she came in 1966, after the 1967 war in Palestine, Israel, you really did see a significant influx of students from Palestine, students from Egypt, students from those areas who came here to the United States. And like her, many of them stayed and have been an incredibly important contributions to our country. During that period, we think about it in terms of more than 400,000 immigrants who came here then. And it is it's a community that was a little different in that they also were more Muslim than Christian during that period. So one of the things I think is important for callers to kind of understand, the majority of Arab Americans in this country are actually Christian. And a plurality, what used to be a majority, but now a plurality of the American Muslim in this country are Black. The single largest growing segment of the American Muslim population is actually Latino. So folks often conflate Arabs and Muslims, the ethnicity with the faith, and obviously that shouldn't happen, but it definitely shouldn't happen with regards to the Arab American community, because it's while the majority of Arabs in the region are Muslim, the majority here, we're talking about American communities, are not. So it's one of those things that I think is just helpful for folks to understand. And it's also interesting to go back to our conversation about Dearborn. Dearborn is definitely majority Arab American and definitely majority Arab American Muslim, but that is not reflective of the broader demographics of Arab Americans in the country. So I love talking about Dearborn, but what I try carefully not to do is to suggest that it represents the broader community nationally entirely.
And very illuminating for a lot of our listeners, I'm sure. All right, one more oral history call. Michelle in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. And Michelle, we only have about a minute for you, but I'm glad I got to squeeze you in. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for taking my call. So yes, my great-grandparents immigrated from Lebanon to Chicago. And then my grandfather, my Shidju, moved to Minneapolis, where there was, I'm told, the first Lebanese mayor. So that's why he ended up immigrating to Minneapolis, and my Shidju was with him. And that's where we all grew up. And he ended up becoming Hubert Humphrey's closest advisor. And held the Bible for Hubert Humphrey while he was sworn in as Vice President of the United States. And we are, to the guest's point, we are Christian Lebanese.
Hubert Humphrey, who was Lyndon Johnson's Vice President and then the Democratic nominee for President in 1968, though he lost to Richard Nixon. Do you have any story from, his time advising the Vice President?
I mean, I just know, you know, he wasn't an educated guy. He was kind of a street guy. It was kind of like a consigliere. I'm told that Hubert really trusted him. I have pictures of Hubert Humphrey, you know, holding my siblings and, you know, me, you know, kind of hanging on my mom's leg when I was a little kid. I've got a picture of my mom dancing with JFK. But, you know, I know my sister, she didn't graduate beyond ninth, she stopped going to school at like 9 years old. So to go from that to being, you know, dancing with JFK and hanging with Hubert Humphrey is kind of cool.
That's a great story. That what an American story, Maya, right? American immigration story.
I could just join you to listen to these callers, these incredible stories. This is the story of Arab Americans. That is exactly the kind of history that's there, and one that's, you know, not often understood, so, which is why I'm so grateful that Arab American Heritage Month exists. It is addressing, frankly, our exclusion and our erasure, and these stories, these wonderful narratives, explain why it's so important to do.
And there's a lot more we could do, but we're out of time for this segment. And so we leave it there for today with Maya Berry, Executive Director of the Arab American Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan national civil rights advocacy organization. Thanks so much for coming on again and hearing these stories with us from our wonderful callers. And thank you for being such a great guest.
Thank you, Brian.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With us now, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, who has a new book called The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society. Among other things, he centers a much-needed inspection of how we use the word freedom in the context of our financial lives, and he argues that the way the idea of freedom has been weaponized has led to economic pain for so many Americans and others. We will hear this case. Joseph Stiglitz is the chief economist of the Roosevelt Institute think tank and an economics professor at Columbia. He won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2001 for research on the theory of markets with asymmetric information. And I know that sounds really wonky, but I'm actually going to ask him about that too, because it might relate to how much you pay for health insurance. Among many other things, Joseph Stiglitz was the chair of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors and then chief economist of the World Bank later in the Clinton years, the late 1990s. Again, the book is called The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society. Professor Stiglitz, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be here.
Let's just dive right into your critique of how the political right uses the word freedom when it comes to economics. What's their definition, and what's their political strategy around it?
Well, their definition is that any individual should be free to do whatever he wants, whatever the consequences for others. And that's the key point, what one person does in our modern, urbanized, integrated society, what one person does can have very adverse effects on others. That's why we, going back to a primitive economy society, we have the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill. That's actions of one affects others. What I point out is one person's freedom can lead to the unfreedom of others, or as Isaiah Berlin put it, freedom for the wolves is death for the sheep.
Huh. But they go so far, you write, as to argue that all other freedoms flow from economic freedom. Can you explain that case, even though you disagree with it?
Well, they contend that you can only have political freedom if you have economic freedom. And that was why, for instance, Friedrich Hayek wrote the book, The Road to Serfdom, in the middle of the last century, as he saw the growth of the welfare state, the growth of Keynesian economics, where government took an increasingly important role in stabilizing the economy. He contended that all of these actions by government were paving the road to serfdom. The argument of my book is he got it 180 degrees wrong, that the government's doing too little led to populism. Populism has provided a fertile field for demagogues and is paving the road to serfdom. It is the problem is not government doing too much. the problem arises from government doing too little.
Yeah. And the oldest, well, you mentioned the Hayek book. I guess around the same time, there was the very influential 1962 book, Capitalism and Freedom, by the very influential conservative economist Milton Friedman. And you summed up his version of freedom in your book with that Isaiah Berlin quote, freedom for the wolves, death for the sheep. But I want to get into it a little more because he challenged what he called naive Keynesian theory. I'm quoting from Wikipedia now on his philosophy. So you'll tell me if this is right. Wikipedia is usually accurate. But he challenged what he called naive Keynesian theory, beginning with his interpretation of consumption, which tracks how consumers spend. And I gather he thought too much government stimulus to create full employment would lead to too much inflation, and that would be worse. And there are those who argue today that that's what we're living through right now with the effects of too many rounds of COVID stimulus. Would you argue back against the theory and the current link to inflation from government spending?
Exactly. If you look over the long period, we've actually had very stable inflation, and the result of government intervention is that booms are longer and downturns are shorter and less deep. We haven't had another Great Depression. And it was we recovered from the Great Recession. We would have recovered faster if we had had more government fiscal support. It was the conservatives, the Republicans, that tied our hands in not allowing more government support. But coming to the recent round of inflation, it's very clear, and I've argued this with data, that it's a pandemic-related supply-side shortages, demand shifts. People wanted to live in different places. It was not excess aggregate demand that led to the current bout of inflation. And this argument is not, my position is now widely accepted. The evidence is that we've been able to bring down the rate of inflation dramatically without any increase in the level of unemployment. Very contrary to what the head of the Federal Reserve, chairman of the Federal Reserve said, he said that it would have to have 5% unemployment to bring inflation down. He was absolutely wrong. And there's some economists, the one at Harvard, for instance, who suggested we would have to have 7.5% of unemployment for 2 years to bring down inflation. He was even obviously more wrong. The fact is that markets worked reasonably well in relieving the supply constraints. And as those supply constraints were relieved, inflation came down very quickly.
Since you bring that up, are you skeptical of the need to keep interest rates as high as they are?
Yes, I am. It was important to normalize interest rates, but we went well beyond that, and we went well beyond that too fast, and that has put at risk our economy. The good news is that the Biden administration has been very effective in providing a growth agenda that has provided, in turn, strong fiscal support, not only with the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS and Science Act, the IRA. Had it not been for those, we would be in very bad shape, as Europe is today. They've had to respond to our high interest rates, but they haven't had the fiscal support, and countries like Germany are stagnating or in recession. So we've caused the global slowdown, but we've been protected ourselves by the strong fiscal support that we've had.
Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, is our guest with his new book, The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society. Listeners, we can take your phone calls for him, your comments and questions on freedom, the word freedom, and the economy, your personal economy and the national economy and global economies, and this notion of freedom and how that word is used, questions and comments, 212-433-WNYC, call or text 212-433-9692. And in the book, you also center a critique of neoliberalism, which many non-economists have no idea what that means, but you say it's very much what our economic system is based on these days. Would you define neoliberalism so people can use it at their next cocktail party?
Sure. Neo refers to new. Liberalism refers to liberating, giving freedom. It was the idea that liberating the economy from regulations, reducing taxes, you would lead to unprecedented economic growth. The neo refers to the fact that this is a 20th century liberalism, in contrast to 19th century liberalism. In fact, there was very little difference. It wasn't an updating. And we've now had 40 years of results from this experiment. And what happened was growth declined markedly to one-third of what it was before. And what growth occurred went all to the top. Those at the bottom were actually worse off, contrary to another doctrine of neoliberalism, which was called trickle-down economics, let the rich get richer and everybody will benefit. So the main tenets of neoliberalism have really been refuted by the evidence, but actually the underlying theory that free and unfettered markets would lead to economic efficiency, economic growth, well-being, had been refuted even before it became fashionable. My own work, you mentioned I got the Nobel Prize in asymmetric information. My own work showed that whenever information was imperfect, which of course is always, or markets were imperfect, which again is almost always, markets are not actually efficient, and that there is a role for government intervention.
And you say neoliberalism, as you've been describing, is the source of massive inequalities in our country and of today's dangerous populism, and we'll get to the populism. But to many listeners, you know, that critique will sound like, oh, neoliberalism is conservative, but the word neoliberalism sounds like it's a new liberalism, which sounds like it might be progressive. So what's the context of the word liberal? I guess you were getting at it with 19th century liberalism versus 20th century liberalism, but it's not liberal in the way that people usually say liberal or conservative, right?
That's right. It's a usage actually in the United States, which is different in most of the rest of the world. In most of the rest of the world, liberalism has been associated with stripping away regulations. In the United States, liberal is associated with the Democratic Party. And that's just an odd difference in the usage of words. The fact of the matter is that stripping away regulations like on pollution gives companies freedom to increase their profits, but it means that the rest of the world, including Americans, have to pay the price. They pay the price in global warming. People with asthma may find themselves at risk for their lives. So expanding the freedom of the companies is actually reducing the freedom of the rest of us. So that's exactly the core point I'm trying to make. When you expand freedoms of some, you may contract the freedoms of others. And actually, I go on to point out, that there are some cases where mild constraints actually can expand the freedom of everybody. For instance, stoplights are a good example where a little regulation saying you can't go until the light is green and you take turns going through the intersection, that allows the traffic to flow. In the absence of that little regulation, you have gridlock and nobody can move. So by a little regulation, everybody's freedom to move is increased. And that general principle is actually widespread, that taxation, which is a constraint, allows for public investments that have extraordinarily high returns, and that can expand the freedom of everybody. Obvious example, if the government hadn't made those investments in the mRNA vaccine platform, we might not be here talking. That led to the vaccine that protected us against COVID-19. So coercion, the fact that you have to pay for that research, has expanded in a meaningful sense all of our freedoms.
And I don't know anybody who's called a government communist for having stoplights so that everybody gets their fair turn to move forward through the intersection. Peter in St. Petersburg, you're on WNYC with Joseph Stiglitz. Hello, Peter.
Ah, finally. Yes, here's what's going on. I told your screener about, like, my history is, like, I graduated from NYU in 1989. And at that time, communism, I'm talking about communism, all fell apart.
Right
you
then.
Remember that?
Right then, 1989, 1990.
I was taking a course called Socialist Theory, and it was taught by a Marxist. And it was just perfect because I was in the class. He wouldn't call on me anymore because I was like, no, no, no. I had read, let's put it, I read Thomas Sowell and Milton Friedman, and I said, I just knew that that was the winning team. And here I am now. I subscribe to Reason Magazine, and here now, going into the 21st century, it's like, forget it. I'm not a libertarian. All those labels, they don't mean anything anymore. I'm just looking at the world and saying, no, that wasn't the winning team after all. So it's like, so I'm interested in your guests to tell me what went wrong, or did nothing go wrong, or what? You know what I mean? I'm saying? The idea of saying libertarian.
It's a great conversation to set up a thread of this conversation on what went wrong compared to what people, including probably President Clinton, who you work for, and maybe you as the chair of his Council of Economic Advisors, thought was going to happen with his economic policies. But what do you say to Peter?
Well, actually, even at the time neoliberalism became fashionable, you know, dating it around 1980 with Reagan and Thatcher, economic theory, my work and that of others have pointed out that unfettered markets didn't actually deliver. Of course, the empirical evidence over the last 40 years has really reinforced that. And as we've seen that, we've come to understand a little bit better what was going on. The agenda, so-called agenda of freedom, of liberalization, was really driven by special interest. Corporations, they wanted to have more profits. They didn't care what the consequences were for the environment. The more they were able to exploit market power, exploit individual vulnerabilities, the higher the profits. But their profits came at the expense of others. Their freedom came at the expense of others. And that's really the point of the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, after 40 years, what I had suggested was the case 45 years ago, we see it so clearly today.
Well, you were President Clinton's Council of Economic advisor's chair in his first 2 years of as president, if I have that right. Was Clinton a neoliberal in the way you use the word?
Well, he was really in between. In the end, it turned out he was neoliberal. We had a lot of fights on within the cabinet. On one side were people like Bob Reich and myself, and the other side there were a number of others, the Secretary of Treasury. And so we had a lot of debates. Some of us warned that trade liberalization was going to lead to more inequality, and we better be prepared. We better have programs that help those that were going to be adversely affected. But we went ahead even without those programs, and my fears turned out to be correct.
And so a little...
But I was able... Let me ahead. One more point.
Sure.
I was really skeptical of financial market liberalization. The history was very clear. Deregulating banks was dangerous. And we had a lot of fights. And during the 4 years I was there, we had stopped it. But after I left, in the last couple of years of the Clinton administration, neoliberalism really swept the Clinton administration. Bob Reich had also left by that point, and that's when we got financial deregulation.
And that banking deregulation is widely considered to have contributed a lot to the mortgage crisis, the financial crisis that began in earnest in 2008. So let me play a clip from back then, because during your time in that position, and I hear you that you were not supporting everything, you were arguing with him and lobbying for certain other positions, but during that time, Clinton signed NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and later he helped bring China into the world trade system, both things very much criticized these days. So here's 30 seconds of President Clinton from his NAFTA signing ceremony speech, November 1993.
No one has shown how a wealthy country can grow wealthier and create more jobs unless there is global economic growth through trade. There is simply no evidence that you can do it any other way. About half America's growth in the last 7 years has come from trade growth. And the jobs that are tied to trade on average pay about 17% more than jobs which are totally within the American economy.
So how much are you cringing hearing that old clip, and how much would you push back?
Well, what I would say is that we didn't fully understand how adverse would be the effects within the United States. He was right that over the long run, if you manage trade well, it can lead to benefits. This is the old theory of comparative advantage, that each country specializing in its comparative advantage leads to growth of income in both sides of the trade agreement. But what I saw when I went to the World Bank was that often when you liberalized trade, when you joined trade agreements for developing countries, what you did is have resources move from low productivity, not into high productivity, but into unemployment. And that, of course, didn't lead to economic growth. And then it turned out that when people looked more carefully at what was going on in the United States, those places in the United States where there was more competition from imports, whether it was under NAFTA from Mexico or whether it was from China after the accession to the WTO, those places had higher unemployment, lower wages, lower property values. So the neoliberal doctrine was that markets adjusted very quickly, and so people would quickly find jobs. That turned out not to be true. and that the impacts within the United States were larger than had been anticipated.
And
now,
I think,
of course,
go ahead, yeah, finish the thought. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that we have to also recognize that a lot of the deindustrialization was not due just to globalization, but to the fact that there was technical change. I come from Gary, Indiana, a steelmaking town, and I went back a few years ago, visited the steel mill, and what they told me is they were producing almost as much steel or as much steel as they used to be, but with a fraction of the labor force. And that's an example where it wasn't trade so much as improvements in productivity. But still, the problem was we were not very good at moving labor from the old economy into the new economy. Mm-hmm. And that was an important lesson we should have taken on board.
Tom in Seabright, New Jersey. You're on WNYC with economist Joseph Stiglitz. His new book, The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Well, Professor, your book obviously refers to the road to serfdom. And I think we are serfs. Most people are serfs in this country. Professors can write their smart books and figure out a little change here, a little change there. We need a new social contract, and we don't have one now. The rich control this country. The only way things are going to change when people have a decent standard of living and some guarantees of a humane life is if there's a mass revolt. You know, if people say, I have enough. You know that lobbyists control Congress and the rich control the lobbyists, and they do what those people want. And Clinton, he was horrible for the middle class. And you can't be proud of having worked with that man. I don't know what we can do short of a revolution, sir. So I don't know. I'll take your comments.
Tom, thank you very much. Well, you know, he mentions revolution, and that cycles back to something you said near the beginning of the segment that I wanted to follow up anyway, because you do write in the book about how our current form of economic freedom, as it's generally practiced, could bring down political freedom, the total opposite of Milton Friedman's old belief that economic freedom promotes other freedoms. This is a dystopian vision that runs through populism and maybe revolution, right?
Exactly. That one of the motivations of my book is echoing, actually, with the caller's points. Government doing too little about inequality, about exploitation, is creating a dystopia and setting the stage for populism and authoritarianism. He is absolutely right that we need a new social contract. We have to provide a decent living standard for more of our citizens, for hopefully all of our citizens. He's absolutely right that in America, money talks too much in politics, and our economic inequality has as a result led to political inequality. But where I disagree with him is a revolution, because the history of revolutions has not been happy. And I actually address that in my book.
Well, there's revolution, and I'm going to jump in because we're almost out of time, but there's revolution and there's revolution. And I think what Tom, talking from the political left, I believe, would be unhappy about what's happening right now, is that, you know, your theory is inequality from neoliberalism fuels what you call populist movements. But what's the big populist movement in America? It's on the right. It's Trump style, right? So how do you explain, how do you understand that this massive inequality, which you might think would lead to more calls by more, let's say, non-college educated working class people who are so broadly victims in our economy the last 30 years, that they would support a more progressive economic blueprint like yours rather than run with Trump?
Well, Trump provides a simplistic vision where he says, blame others, blame immigrants, blame foreign trade, blame others for our problems. My view is, you know, we need to look inside. We need a new social contract, as he says. And that's what, you know, what I'm arguing for here is that we need the kind of minor repairs, a little bit more education here, a little bit change in a regulation there is not going to suffice. We need major changes in our economic system, and I tried to describe those major changes. I think we can do it, but it will take a lot of civic engagement, political force from the people in the left and the center left to combat the simplistic story that says just blame others. And, you know, if we look at the Trump agenda, the 2017 tax cut, it was a tax cut for the billionaires and the corporations. What did he also do? Did he propose getting rid of Obamacare, leaving more people without health care?
Right.
So it was a, when you look at the details of his agenda, it's really worsening the situation we face today.
Before you go, and we just have a few minutes left, and I know this is worthy of much more than the time I'm going to give it. But in your book, you write that despite all the failures and inequities of the current system, so many people still champion the idea of an unfettered free market economy. And you use the example of dealing with healthcare and insurance companies among the downsides. But I read on the Encyclopedia Britannica website that your Nobel Prize was the study for the study of asymmetric markets. And listeners, I'm going to get a little wonky here, but I think it'll be worth it. Britannica says Stiglitz studies, for example, the insurance market, in which uninformed insurance companies lacked information on the individual risk situation of their informed customers. They were informed about their own risks, of course, the people were. The analysis showed that by offering incentives to policyholders to disclose information, insurance companies were able to divide them into different risk classes. The use of a screening process enabled companies to issue a choice of policy contracts in which lower premiums could be exchanged for higher deductibles, unquote. So a little wonky, like I said, but it seems to say you helped empower insurance companies to get us to give up personal data about ourselves so they could make more money off of us. You're going to tell me I'm reading that wrong, right?
Well, what I try to use is to, what I was doing there is describing the way the market worked, and that it worked in ways that could lead to that kind of discrimination. The answer about how to organize society when there are these information problems is quite different. And that's where I've called for instance, it would be better if we had a national system of insurance where everybody pools together and we don't have that kind of discrimination that I described as an inevitable consequence of the markets when even markets for insurance exist. And there were many circumstances what I one of the things our analysis showed was that there were many circumstances in which there were these problems of imperfect and asymmetric information. Asymmetric just means that some people know something that other people don't know, that in those circumstances, markets might not even be able to function. Hmm. And we see that a lot of the most important things that we would like to get insurance for, we can't get insurance. And this idea that you talked about in the insurance markets, what I show is implicit in labor markets, credit markets. That's why there's credit rationing, problems of liquidity in firms and the banking system. It's really pervasive throughout our economy. And that was really part of my critique of why markets on their own don't solve our society's problems, and that there are many arenas where it is we get much better outcomes with programs of some government role, whether it's a public option in health insurance. I actually think there should be a public option in mortgages, government role in providing higher education. We have lots of problems in higher education. So it helps define more precisely the what government needs to do and why markets have so often failed to live up to the promise that Friedman and Hayek held out for us.
And there, folks, we have just been treated to a short explanation of the theory that won Joseph Stiglitz the Nobel Prize in Economics 23 years ago. What a treat. And he's got his new book, The Road to Freedom, Economics, and the Good Society, which obviously we've also been discussing. Really good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Great to talk to you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, listeners, we conclude our fifth anniversary Earth Week experiment, our Brian Lehrer Show Plastics Challenge. Fifth anniversary because we first did this in 2019. On Monday, we invited you to challenge yourselves to notice how many times you encounter single-use plastics all week, and which ones do you think would be the easiest or hardest to avoid? So what did you notice? Time to report back. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Did anyone write down the plastics you used? Keep mental notes? Was there anything that really surprised you? What did you find out, especially if you haven't done this exercise with us before? Did anyone physically hang on to your single-use plastics this week? How big did that pile get? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call in or text and just name one or a few of the single-use plastics that you either can't avoid or successfully avoid in your life already, and anything you have changed personally at any time or have had trouble changing. 212-433-WNYC. And if you weren't new to this week and just want to report on your observations about single-use plastics in your life and your attempts to minimize them, that's okay too. 212-433-9692. And joining us again to wrap up the Brian Lehrer Show Plastics Challenge is Judith Enck, founder of Beyond Plastics, an initiative that works on plastic pollution issues. She's also a professor at Bennington College and former EPA Region 2 administrator, meaning she ran the Federal Environmental Protection Agency for New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and eight Native American nations. That's what comprises EPA Region 2. Judith, welcome back.
Oh, I'm so happy to be with you. Thanks, Brian.
And I will put mine on the table first. Few things I noticed, and some of these observations aren't new, but I noticed them again, and most of them are obvious, but garbage bags. I'll ask you in a minute if there's any way around that every few days. Lots of single-use plastics and things ordered for delivery. In one case, when I ordered a meal, and in one case, when I ordered a product. Both came with the outermost layer being a plastic bag that would presumably be used just once. Lots of kitchen uses in addition to garbage, like a freezer bag where the bag gets soiled enough by the food. That one I actually have eliminated in my life, but I noticed from the time that I did, I still have some freezer bags in my cabinet. So, oh yeah, freezer bags. If you don't want to freeze something else in it because it gets too dirty, it's a single-use bag. And I'll say I went to a Yankee game last weekend, and I saw that drinks come in plastic cups that in most cases get left behind at the person's seat. That's probably thousands of single-use plastic cups after every game, because I don't think I saw even a recyclable symbol on the bottom of the of those cups. And that's presumably thousands in every game in every stadium. So those are a few of mine. Listeners, how about yours? You want to jump in on any of those, Judith?
Sure. And first, I want to say we don't have to be perfect, because it's impossible to avoid plastics until we adopt new laws that drive innovation and change, which is pending in Albany. I don't have a good answer for you on the garbage bags. And, you know, you can get them made from recycled content. If you compost, your garbage won't smell as much. But I do want to talk about the Yankees Cup. The New York City Council recently adopted a law with tremendous leadership from Eric Goldstein at Natural Resources Defense Council that now allows New Yorkers to bring their own refillable containers, your own water bottle, for instance, into large stadiums. So who likes to waste money buying bottled water? I won't make the same case for beer, but you can bring your own cup now to big stadiums. That should be taking effect soon. On the meal delivery front, boy, is that a challenge, especially during COVID. People ordered out a lot. We wanted to support local businesses, restaurants. New York City has a law in place, and other places should adopt it, called Skip the Stuff, where you do not automatically get plastic utensils and straws and condiments unless you specifically ask for it. But I think a much better piece of information for people is there are small businesses popping up. One that comes to mind right away is called Deliver Zero. And you can, if the restaurant is enrolled with Deliver Zero, you can get your food delivered in reusable packaging, and then it gets returned to the restaurant. Deliver Zero arranges to pick it up. It's washed and sanitized and used hundreds of times. I think that is the future for food delivery, and we've got to get the big apps like Uber Eats and Grubhub to embrace reusable packaging. People in New York City now have that option at select restaurants.
That is good information on some choices that people can actually make, even though we know, and it's happened to me, that you don't check, you purposely don't check that you want the plastic utensils. So you're not supposed to get them unless you ask for them, since that law went into effect in New York, and then you get them anyway. So
yeah, it's going to take time. Talk to the restaurant. You can even, you know, that's a violation of law if they automatically give you the utensils and the condiments. You know, we have the utensils at home if you're eating at home. So talk to the restaurant and then report the violations through 311.
Alice in the East Village, I think, is trying to really go as far as she can go on this. Alice, you're on WNYC with Judith Ank. Hi there.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I compost. I compost in two ways. I put the vegetable in the Union Square compost, and then the other I put in the boxes that they have outside. I take glass to reuse places. I wash out plastic bags, and I never buy garbage bags because the garbage, I just use the bag from the kitty litter, and the kitty litter is all flushable. I mean, it just, to me, it's not that hard. I don't understand it. And I bring containers to places. And if they won't use them, I often don't go there. I don't support them.
Thank you for all of that. You want to, I heard you react, Judith, to that garbage bag option. Do you have to have a cat?
No. But, you know, I think the key on the garbage bag issue is if you compost, your garbage is not going to get that wet and smelly. So you can use any kind of paper bag. For garbage. It doesn't have to be a giant plastic bag.
Good one. I'm going to play a clip from after your appearance on Monday's show when we were setting up the plastic challenge. Because after you were on, we got a caller who really got a little scared about one of the things that you said about heating up plastics. That is food that comes in microwavable plastic bags. So let's take a listen to what Rob in Randolph, New Jersey, was concerned about.
One thing that Professor Ank said that really threw a chill through me was the not using plastic inside the microwave. I buy these green beans that are come in a heat-in bag.
Right.
I'm wondering, how bad, you know, how bad that really is, and how much I'm how much damage I'm doing to my health and the health of my family.
And Judith, I couldn't answer his question because I'm not a scientist in this realm, and you didn't mention specifically the leaching from plastics that are used in enclosing, you know, microwavable vegetables. Do you have a take?
Oh, I sure do, and I appreciate this call. Heat can increase the leaching of chemicals from plastics, and 16,000 different chemicals are used in a variety of different plastics. So I really want your listeners to understand that it is a mistake to put plastics in the microwave. I'm talking about plasticizers, which make plastic more flexible and durable. One of the most common is something called phthalates, which is linked to a number of health problems, even at low levels. So phthalates have been linked to increased risk of cancer, diabetes, reproductive disorders, neurological impairments. I am not saying that if you microwave your green beans and the green beans are healthy, that you're going to have that health impact. But I am saying that phthalates, even at low levels, have been connected to these health problems. So look, many years ago, I used to put like easy, quick microwavable dinners in the microwave, and it tasted like plastic. And that's when I stopped doing it. But I really want to emphasize that heat can increase the leaching of chemicals. So don't put any plastic in the microwave. And that also applies to any kind of bags that, like for roasting or for steaming. Do not heat those bags, either in the microwave or just in boiling water. And particularly if it's something that you eat a lot, you know, some chemical leaching is not good for you ever, but if it's once a year versus once a week, that's something you really need to pay attention to.
Yeah.
And I think on Monday I mentioned avoid microwavable popcorn because the inside is coated with PFAS chemicals that also leach.
So should your friends at your old employer, the Environmental Protection Agency, do studies and risk assessments of things like green beans in microwavable bags to see how much health risk there actually is? I don't know if it's been quantified based on your answer.
It would be helpful if the EPA or other regulatory agencies did that, particularly the FDA. But there is enough independent science that links particularly the problems with phthalates and all the illnesses I rattled off. I haven't seen anything that says, okay, if you microwave plastic, you know, once a month, once a week, what is the health outcome? But we definitely don't need to wait that long to know that it is not a good thing to be doing.
We are with Judith Enck, the founder of the group Beyond Plastics, as we wrap up our fifth anniversary Brian Lehrer Show Plastics Challenge for this Earth Week 2024, fifth anniversary because we first did this in 2019, where we invite you to notice the single-use plastics in your life during the week and call in with what you noticed, and Judith's commenting on ways to reduce them. We're going to get into a little more of the politics as we go. And I'm going to ask you about a plastics industry commercial, Judith. I don't know if you've seen it.
I'll hold this thought for the moment.
On MSNBC, of all places, that I saw this morning. So we're going to get to that. But first, we're going to get to Michael in Manhattan. Michael, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I have become aware of, and I actually took Judith's class and mentioned this at some point, prescriptions in America in 1922, there were 6.7 billion prescriptions filled. And if I have to assume that the majority of them were delivered in the orange plastic bottles that I think everyone's familiar with, and they're made from number five plastic, that polypropylene, Judith, is that correct?
Correct.
And it's not easily recycled. It often contains a lot of additives like lead and cadmium, and it's thrown into landfill. And in Europe, I had a friend who moved to Europe recently, and I asked him to look into their method of delivering prescriptions. And he sent me back a cardboard box which contained blister packs of pills, and you just pushed them out as you needed them. And not only the added benefit was that on the top of the cardboard box, the medication, and I can't tell what else, was put in Braille. I tried to start something called Stop the Orange Menace, and I actually put up an email, stop.orange.menace, and I don't know. I went out on Earth Day, and I gave out papers asking people to write to their congresspeople about this, and
I want to jump in for time and get Judith to respond on these number 5 orange prescription plastic bottles.
Yeah, we are contacted a lot on this. So thanks for the plug for my class, which is available online to auditors. And that the Orange Menace thing could apply to a number of problems in the United States these days. But it's billions of these little orange number 5 plastics. And in most communities, you can't recycle it. I've spoken to my own pharmacist and said, you know, can you at least have a drop-off recycling program? She said no. Interestingly, I was just contacted by a company recently that is manufacturing aluminum prescription bottles made from recycled material, and can, when you're done, you just pop it in your recycling bin like any other aluminum. I asked the guy a bunch of questions. He said it is FDA approved. He worked in the pharmaceutical industry for decades and was appalled by the volume of plastics used by pharmaceutical companies. So I'm not endorsing a particular company here, but I do want to tell you, I heard from this company called Pillumina, Pillumina. And they say that they are ready to get into pharmacies. And customers need to ask for it. So that might be an option. Pill bottles are complicated because you have FDA regulations. So it's not covered by packaging reduction laws that we're working on. But I'm encouraged that at least one big company is giving us an alternative to plastic pill bottles.
Michael, thank you for your call. Let me go through a couple that came in via text message. About things that people noticed this week in the plastics challenge or things that they're citing as difficult to get rid of. Listener writes, the plastic challenge made me very aware of the huge number of scrubby kitchen sponges we go through and how we know it's time to throw them out when they start to shed microplastics into our water, cookware, and bodies, presumably. Listener writes, we just cannot find a comparable, sustainable alternative that's as durable, flexible, and effective as the traditional sponge. Thought about that?
Yeah, that's a problem. Again, we don't have to be perfect.
Yeah.
There are zero waste stores and refill stores popping up all over New York City and the country. And some of these stores offer equivalent sponges that are not made from plastic, do not shed microplastic. I often will also sometimes just use clean rags and throw the rags into the laundry. But, you know, when you have stubborn, pans, like I'm sadly multitasking and have been known to burn dinner from time to time, you really do need something that has some power to it, and steel wool. And I have seen in my supermarket, you know, like metal scrubbies, not plastic, and they well.
An alternative. Listener writes in response to Michael's call on the pill bottles, CVS and Rite Aid have take back boxes. You can drop off unused medication along with the plastic bottles. That doesn't tell us that they actually recycle those plastic bottles or reuse them, but at least you can drop them off instead of putting them in your waste stream. A number of the texts, a lot of texts that we're getting have to do with how food is packaged. So berries lettuce greens. One listener writes, get mushrooms out of plastic. What about all of that? And we also have a question about these very thin, that text has already gone from my screen, but I'll summarize it. These kind of very thin, what appear to be plastics, but are they even plastics, that sometimes lettuce and things like that come in the supermarket, but supposedly they're degradable?
Yeah. So not long ago, we could get all of our lettuce and our greens with no packaging at all. And you still can in many stores. But the stores are really, in terms of product positioning, the first thing you see if you want greens, I call them plastic coffins for lettuce and greens. And I'm concerned about storing greens in plastic for a long time. I find it very easy to just reach for the lettuce and the greens a little further down the produce aisle that does not come in plastic coffins. And then while we're in that part of the supermarket, I want to say a lot of people have questions about the thin plastic produce bags. It would be nice if some stores would give you the option of paper bags like it used to be.
Yeah.
But I bring cloth reusable bags with me, and I'm a busy, forgetful person. So I just leave bags, like collapsible bags, in my purse or in my car. I know not everyone in the metro area drives the car to the supermarket, but if you leave it in the car, you're more likely to remember it. And then I just toss in the reusable produce bags along with my regular bags so I don't forget.
One more from a text message, and then we're out of time. We could keep going on this for hours because there are just so many single-use plastics examples that people are chiming in with. But listener writes, I just can't kick those single-use floss picks because I don't like regular dental floss. But I'll add, Judith, that I think regular dental floss in most cases is plastic too, right? Plus it's got the microplastics coating, depending on the brand.
Yeah, and PFAS, because that's what makes it slippery. Yeah, I mean, boy, this is a conflict with our dentist, isn't it? Our dentist tells us we have to keep flossing, and those little picks really are convenient. What I'm shocked at is how many of them I see littered on the street. You know, I guess the only real alternative is the water pick, where you splash the water on your teeth. That's what I use, and really good brushing.
I know my dentist recommends the water pick as
it's expensive.
Very effective. I don't know that means don't floss, but I know they recommend it.
It probably doesn't. You're going to get calls from dentists, I guarantee you.
Yes.
I tend to use the water pick more than flossing. I will floss if I have like a very large seed in my teeth that I can't get rid of.
And I said I was going to ask you about the plastics industry TV campaign. So I saw a commercial this morning as I was taking in some news and comment on Morning Joe on MSNBC. And there was a commercial from plasticsomething.org. I didn't catch it. But it was, an industry association, and it was all about the great ways that the plastics industry is developing new, more recyclable forms of plastic so that we can have lots of convenience in our lives and it'll be good for the environment. Would you like a little rebuttal time to that?
Yeah, especially since I don't have the millions of dollars to counter program. I mean, I think the plastics industry knows that people have serious concerns about the proliferation of plastic. So they've gone on a public relations offensive. I did hear yesterday there's in the last 3 months, they spent about $600,000 just advertising on social media. I don't know the cost of their ad buy. It's a very misleading ad. I see it all the time. It ruins my evening. The reality is plastic recycling is only 5 to 6%, because by design, most plastics are not recyclable. Keep recycling your paper, metal, glass, and cardboard, but let's be honest about the failure of plastics recycling. And then the other thing I think they're kind of alluding to is the new public relations push of something called chemical recycling, which is even worse. I think we're seeing the ads a lot in New York because Assemblymember Deborah Glick and Senator Pete Harkin are very close to passing a comprehensive packaging reduction law that would require 50% reduction in plastic packaging over 12 years. Lots of information on that on our website. We're doing a lobby day and rally in Albany on May 14th. You're all invited. So I think there's probably a heavier push in the New York market than other parts of the country.
Maybe you should clarify. And by the way, I'll throw in that in response to the person with the plastic scrubby sponges, a few people have written, you know, I use a cloth dish rag and it can work really well. So just saying to that listener, at least a few people are saying that. On what you just said, and we have 30 seconds left, some plastics, even when they actually get recycled, when we put them in the recyclable stream, the recycle stream, some plastics are recyclable, some are not recyclable, and even some with numbers on the bottom are not recyclable locally. So can you give us a 30-second quick course on that?
Yeah, typically only number one and number two are recycled, but unfortunately a lot of them are exported to other countries where it creates problems. So I want to mention tomorrow there's a screening of a wonderful film called The Story of Plastic, which talks about how the U.S. is exporting so much plastic to other countries. This is a screening tomorrow at the Queen's Botanical Garden at 2 o'clock, part of the Climate Arts Festival. This is an Emmy-awarded movie that looks at places like Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines, and now Turkey and Africa, where the U.S. is exporting a lot of plastics and creating profound problems in those countries.
Nice. At Queen's Botanical Garden. And then you can walk around and see the plants and the flowers. Which
yeah,
is actually
2 o'clock.
Two o'clock.
Go. It's going to be
fantastic time of year to go to the botanical gardens, too. Judith Enck, founder of Beyond Plastics and professor at Bennington College and former EPA Region 2 administrator covering New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and eight Native American nations. Judith, thank you for participating again and helping to guide our fifth anniversary Brian Lehrer Show Plastics Challenge.
With pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.